I think, frankly, we're being ostriches in the sand here. With the US, China, and EU basically at loggerheads with each other, the prospects for any meaningful cooperation, at least on a multilateral level, are pretty dim. And so it's going to be each country opportunistically trying to figure out what we can do.
Welcome to Development Dialogues, a podcast series bringing together experts from research and policy to answer questions that are key to addressing today's most complex global development challenges. We'll discuss how the latest research in development economics can inform strategies to fight poverty, reduce inequality, and drive inclusive economic growth. Development Dialogues is a collaboration between Yale's Economic Growth Center and VoxDev. Hello, and welcome to Development Dialogues. I'm your host, Catherine Cheney. In this episode, we'll ask, how can more economies break free from the sidelines of global trade, especially as globalization faces new headwinds? For decades, global trade seemed to move steadily toward deeper integration, with falling tariffs and proliferating trade agreements. But significant barriers have kept many low- and middle-income countries from benefiting. Now, with the election of President Donald Trump in the US and rising protectionism globally, the rules of trade are being rewritten, and this creates a more complex reality for developing countries. Joining us are three leading experts on these issues. Two of them are economists focused on the link between international trade and economic development. Amit Khandelwal is the Dong Su Han Professor of Global Affairs and Economics at Yale University, with appointments at the Economics Department and the Jackson School. And Isabella Manalich is an assistant professor in the Department of Economics at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Amit was a senior editor, and Isabella was a co-editor, for a VoxDev Lit on International Trade, which summarizes the evidence on the impact of international trade in developing countries. We're also joined by Arvind Subramanian, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, who was the former chief economic advisor to the government of India. Arvind has written about how Trump's return could in fact be an opportunity for India. Trump's plan to impose steep import tariffs spells trouble for India, given its expanding trade surplus with the US. But Arvind says that by opening its domestic market to American businesses and pursuing a bilateral trade agreement, India has the opportunity to deepen its relationship with Washington while also revitalizing its manufacturing sector. Together, Amit, Isabella, and Arvind will discuss the opportunities and challenges for India and other developing economies navigating a changing global trade system. Amit, Isabella, Arvind, thank you so much for joining us.
With pleasure.
Pleasure to be here.
So I'd like to start with you, Amit. The VoxDev Lit on International Trade highlights how, despite trade reforms in many low- and middle-income countries, there are still significant barriers that prevent their full integration into global markets. So what do you see as some of the key reasons that these barriers persist?
When we started out to write this review, we wanted to emphasize what's different about international trade when a developing country opens up to the global economy and what effects there would be on the economy relative to, say, the United States opening up to the world. When you ask that question, you immediately have to confront different characteristics of developing countries compared to rich countries. There's been a lot of work in the academic literature trying to understand what the broad characteristics of developing countries are and how they might interact with international trade. There's things like weaker institutions and the fact that the implementation of the rule of law may be weaker in a developing country relative to a rich country. And then we asked the question, well, what does that mean when a country lowers its trade barriers and the rule of law is in fact weaker than we might typically expect in a developed country? Another one could be that there may be particular markets for inputs that firms may need in order to participate in international trade once that opportunity presents itself. And if the functioning of those markets, such as land markets or labor markets, is not as strong as it would be in a developed country, how does the impact of trade interact with that? And then finally, we realize that in many developing countries, you often have some firms that are more favored than others. It could be for political reasons, it could be for military reasons, for other types of firm-level distortions we might think about. And as a result, how international trade affects an economy may be different as a result of those. And so what we tried to zero in on is what's special about international trade in a developing country, and trying to understand how a trade barrier, when it falls 10% in a developed country, is going to have some effect, and how might those effects be different as a result of these three broad distortions.
I know that You've done extensive research on India and China, and your research suggests that context matters greatly, of course. But any lessons that policymakers elsewhere can draw from their experience, or reasons that we should be focusing on these countries?
Prior to 2005, most of the world's apparel that was sourced from developing countries were imported under quotas. So the United States signed a bilateral agreement with China, which said we will import 1,000 shirts. It's a lot more than that, but let's say 1,000 shirts from China, 75 shirts from India, 85 shirts from Nigeria, and so forth. And that system of quotas was removed in 2005, when now developing countries all over the world could compete on an equal footing. So if you ask that question, what is the effect of the removal of quotas in a country where now many firms can start to export without needing this requirement from the Chinese government to export? There's going to be some benefit now that this participation into the global apparel economy is now broader. But what we realized is that in some developing countries, China in particular, when the quotas were being allocated, what the government would do is they would negotiate a number of shirts that it would export to the United States. It would then turn to its firms and allocate who's going to produce how many of those 1,000 shirts. What we noticed is that the set of firms that it allocated the licenses to were what we might think of as much more inefficient firms relative to what we might expect firms who could have properly bid on the prices. As a result, when you remove the license and you get rid of any kind of quota requirements in 2005, you get a big reshuffling away from these really inefficient firms who are favored towards a much more vibrant private sector economy where efficiencies and quality really matter. And I think that's one thing that's useful to think about in a developing country setting, where there may be favored firms who get access to special opportunities where, in this case, free trade levels the playing field for everyone.
I'm going to be much less intelligent and much more reductive than Amit has been. I think the big picture is, at least I can speak for the two or three economies that I know well, that when China and India opened up and liberalized, the first order effects were dramatic on their export growth, trade growth, and overall economic growth. Just to give you one example, India, which has always been considered closed, inefficient economy, et cetera, when it opened up in 1991, over the next 20, 25 years, exports grew in dollar terms by about 12 to 14% per year, every year for 25 years. And the interesting thing was, it wasn't just services exports that grew in India, but also manufacturing exports. So first order effect, unambiguous improvements in these countries. However, where Amit is absolutely right is that pattern of that trade growth and export growth were very different in China and India because of pre-existing conditions. India did not allow firms to become big, for example. So the trade growth was either in high-skilled services or high-skilled manufacturing, whereas apparel, low-skilled manufacturing didn't do very well. China, on the other hand, just to give you one statistic, since 2005, at its peak, China's share of global trade in low-skill exports was something like 30 to 35%, or, you know, some enormously high number like that. Now, the reason why I say these big first-order things should be kept in mind is, I hope we'll come later on to this whole anxiety about globalization that we're all enthralled to. And I want to make the case that while the impacts on advanced countries from this globalization may have been adverse, the China shock and so on, the first-order effects on Vietnam, Bangladesh, all these countries, they were absolutely first-order and positive. And that has gotten lost in this whole retreat from globalization. And that's why I think you want to keep that big first order effect in mind.
I want to bring Isabella in here. Can you talk a little bit more about your research on the impact of multinationals on firms and workers in developing countries, and then the role of industrial policy?
Opening to trade and opening to the attraction of foreign capital, and typically in the form of attraction of foreign multinationals, typically go hand in hand. Multinationals tend to be the largest exporters and importers in most economies. They're also perceived to be the most advanced in terms of the technologies they use, in terms of their organizational practices. Therefore, countries around the world are very excited to attract affiliates of these foreign multinationals to their economies. They do so by dedicating often scarce resources, public resources. These firms tend to be favored, not only from a fiscal perspective, but also having less red tape that they need to deal with, streamlined administrative processes. So what is the typical rationale for favoring these firms? The rationale is that as they expand in less advanced economy, they bring with them that know-how that has been developed in advanced economies, and through interactions with local firms, local workers, local consumers, that know-how is propagated through the receiving economy. In existing work with my co-authors, we look at the impact of joining the supply chain of a foreign multinational affiliate in the context of a less advanced economy, mainly Costa Rica. Long story short, there are very compelling positive effects on the new domestic firms that join the supply chain of a multinational, both in terms of their improvements in organizational capacity, in terms of their reputation vis-a-vis other buyers. But the story needs to be nuanced. Many multinationals operate in silos. They do not integrate deeply with the local economy. Therefore, these type of opportunities of firm level upgrading might not be broadly diffused in the local economy. There's other work, both of my team of co-authors and others, who highlight other ways through which the knowledge of foreign multinationals can be diffused in the local economy, for instance, through worker mobility. Again, in countries where multinationals are significantly more attractive employers because of the wage premium that they pay and also because of additional valuable amenities, it is not very frequent that workers want to move away from a foreign multinational to a domestic employer. But to the extent that they do, or they become entrepreneurs, that's another way for that knowledge to be diffused locally. Another way through which multinationals can impact receiving economies is through shifting norms, for instance, enforcement of and upgrading of labor standards. So here I'm thinking about responsible sourcing policies that multinationals might enact. And as always, the story is nuanced. If you are a benefiting, responsible supplier who is productive enough, able enough to comply with the new labor standards, then there are good things happening to the supplier itself and to the remaining workers. But once we start thinking about the general equilibrium implications of responsible sourcing policies, there might also be unexpected leakage effects in the local economy.
Arvind, I wonder if you can bring some of your perspective from working in policy when it comes to policy around multinational corporations. How did that come up in your work from the Indian context?
Isabella makes a very good point that often when opening up to trade goes hand in hand with opening up to foreign direct investment, then the benefits are perhaps greater. And the real exception which proves what Isabella is saying is India itself. India has opened up to trade, but has attracted much less FDI than other countries. And that's why it's never become part of these global value chains, which has impacted its ability to export, especially labor-intensive products. But then there's also the very interesting example of Korea, which never attracted FDI, but became an export powerhouse because domestic policy, especially in the 70s and 80s, basically said, we're going to use industrial policies to promote these big conglomerates. And in fact, Korea was pretty hostile to FDI because they wanted to promote these. And yet they've gone along and become some of the world's biggest exporters and even gone up the value-added chain. Think of Samsung, Hyundai, and others. So even with FDI, there's interesting variation across countries. But it reinforces the point that Isabella made, that India did not get enough FDI and therefore did stay out of value chains, and therefore, I think to some extent, paid the price of not being able to export. You know, Bangladesh apparel sector was based on FDI, and India has had no FDI in the apparel sector, so hasn't done very well. So the other point I would make, which is for me, I find interesting, is that if you look at China and, you know, some of the other countries, and even Korea going back, they didn't use a lot of fairly heterodox policies, right? For example, in China, you had a lot of aggressive export promotion via free trade zones, for example. You also had a very aggressive, exchange rate policy, and that contributed a lot to the growth in trade. India, on the other hand, did actually very little industrial policy, did very little aggressive exchange rate management, and yet over 25 years managed to do pretty well on overall export growth. So that again reinforces what Amit said. There is country-specific, institution-specific features which can at least affect the nature of trade that happens, being part of value-added chains, labor-intensive versus high-skill-intensive things, and so on. The way I like to provocatively put it is that the Indian export experience is kind of boilerplate Washington consensus. You liberalize imports, your exports grow without any industrial policy or aggressive exchange rate policy.
Yeah, so Arvind, I was going to ask you about that. So in your experience in India, you have this kind of view that you just articulated, which is if you liberalize trade, our effects of how we think about trade are going to happen. Prices are going to come down. Firms are going to participate. But my sense from China was that the reformers in China, when they were thinking about trade policy, it was really one of which there's this quote by Zhu Rongji, the rapid water should wash away the dirty sands. So it was this idea that trade will not just bring access to technology and cheaper inputs, but it'll also allow us to push out the really unproductive but potentially quite powerful firms. And I'm curious if that discussion emerges in the context of India or if you've seen it in your experience.
That's a really great point. And it's something that's really very interesting about China and India. You see, if you go back, both countries had pretty bad experiences with colonization. And in both cases, the grievance against a thing related to trade. China was forced to open its trade under the opium trade, and India also was exploited by deindustrialization. So both countries began ambivalent about trade. But when China opened up, and this is, I think, the really nice point that Amit is making, is that not only was it used to cull out the less efficient enterprises, but they used external trade policy and joining the WTO as an anchor to pursue domestic policy reform. India did nothing of that sort. In India, trade liberalization and domestic policy reform kind of proceeded orthogonally. And therefore, the irony is that both suffered colonial humiliation, but one was able to pragmatically move beyond it, use trade to do a lot of domestic reform, whereas the other, India, was still stuck in this East India Company syndrome. And while it did the trade liberalization because it had no other choice, it was facing a crisis, it never did it out of real conviction and wanting to use it as a way of making the economy more competitive and efficient more broadly. And it's a bit of a puzzle because you can't explain it by history because both had pretty similar histories on that.
I salute the point of view of Arvind that maybe industrial policy is not always necessary or even advisable, especially when governments are lacking capacity to choose winners wisely. That said, I think the interest in industrial policy is here to stay, both in the developed and in the developing world. I am increasingly interested in learning about both empirical studies of the effectiveness of industrial policy, which I think only in recent years with more detailed administrative data sets or smart uses of historical episodes were able to undertake. And also beyond the effectiveness of industrial policy, to think more critically as to whether, from an optimal perspective, industrial policies are welfare enhancing. So asking ourselves, what are the coordination failures that these industrial policies might be addressing? Or are they maybe targeting industries that otherwise would not have developed in that country, despite that country having a latent comparative advantage in that particular industry? Whether we like them or not, they're here to stay. And I think the developing world is looking at countries like the United States, like Germany, and many others who are nowadays pursuing a more nationalist approach from both economic and political perspective, and asking themselves whether they should passively see what the industrial policies of the developed world have in store for them, or whether they should even attempt to compete, and whether that's even wise to do.
Isabella, just to reassure you, India has also succumbed to industrial policy now. It's using investment subsidies massively to attract investment. The experiment is relatively new, but so far the jury is out. Maybe in the electronics sector, there's some evidence that this has increased exports. But in the other sectors, the default is skepticism unless proven otherwise.
Isabella mentioned new signals coming from the United States and other countries. Of course, the election of President Trump in the United States signals what's being described as a retreat from globalization and free trade. Can you talk us through how this development complicates the picture for this big question we're tackling of how can developing economies adapt to a changing global trade system and break free from the sidelines? Why is that suddenly more complicated?
Just to put a little bit of perspective, from the 2018-2019 tariff hikes that we saw, we've learned a little bit about what the impacts on developing countries could be, at least in the short time horizon that's elapsed since then. So maybe we can use that as a way to gauge what might happen with further tariffs. So to give this a sense, like the US ended up raising tariffs on about $450 billion worth of trade. This was about 20% of US imports, with tariff rates going up about 20%. So think of this as 20% of US imports being tariffed, tariffs going up by 20%, and imports as a share of GDP between 15 to 20%. So it's, you know, 0.2 times 0.2 times 0.2 is kind of the magnitude in terms of GDP of what we're looking at. And of course, trade partner countries, predominantly China, did not sit silent, and they also retaliated by imposing tariffs on the US goods. So there's an impact on the US and China that we can walk through. But if we take a step back and think about all these, what we would call bystander countries, countries not directly affected by the trade war, you know, I think the natural thing to consider is that this may be now an opportunity. So India, Cambodia, Vietnam now see the US imposing tariffs on China. That means that Americans are likely to buy less Chinese goods. Maybe they buy more American goods, but the most likely scenario is they look at other low-cost providers of similar products that could be coming from their own countries. In some work that we did with some co-authors, we looked exactly at this, which is let's take the set of products that experienced the tariff hikes by US and China on each other, and then to what extent did India's or Cambodia's or Vietnam's exports in those products increase relative to the products that were not tariffed. And by and large, you find on average, this result of countries did step in and start to export more to the US does in fact happen, but it's actually quite heterogeneous. Countries like Vietnam and Cambodia, they're really strong responders to the tariffs. And so it seems like there's an opportunity that they're able to exploit in terms of their exports. But other countries, India being one of them, it's not the case. And so we see this really big differences between countries kind of responding to this exact same shock that's happening. And then you might imagine that Vietnam, they take advantage by exporting their goods to the US. But in order to get those goods to the US, they have to get them from somewhere else. Maybe they stop exporting to Europe. And so what's happening is they're just shifting their trade from Europe and now going into the US. But for a subset of countries, we find that's not the case. They actually are able to export more to the US, also more to other countries as well. And so there's a handful of countries that really seem to benefit from the trade war. We're trying to dive into why that would be the case. But then equally interesting is why are some countries, in some subsequent work I wrote on India, India is one example of a country that at the time, up until 2019, did not seem to benefit from the trade war, and trying to understand why that's in fact the case. And so that also, again, points to this layer of like domestic internal policies as being the constraints, and maybe domestic policy needs to be a complement to the international trade policy that's happening.
I think some countries in the developing world are looking up to recent developments in the United States and are wondering whether they should emulate their policies and themselves become more nationalist, put their country first, make their country great again. And I think there is a concern. Most low and middle income countries, their own domestic market is not big enough so that they can only focusing on their own internal market, they can experience the sustained poverty alleviation that they need. So I don't think that they should emulate that model. I think strengthening international alliances, continuing to invest in economic diplomacy with partners that are predictable, that have large, prosperous domestic markets, that are technologically advanced, I think remains the winning strategy. That said, I think it's important for most countries to also focus inwards on one's own economy and institutions. I think there is a lot of discontent in the developing world as to whether globalization has gone too far. And when there is not a sense that the gains from trade have been widely distributed in those countries, then those countries themselves start having a backlash against multinationals, against deep integration with other economies. So understanding why is it that country doesn't have a growing, healthy middle class with a strong purchasing power that is politically unsettled and backlashing against globalization, I think that's also important.
I completely agree with what Isabella says about some countries, even like India, start deluding themselves that they have big markets and think, you know, we can go it on our own. And that's a bit of a mistake. But what I would push back against, what actually Lant Pritchett calls intellectual mimicry, that the fact that inequality rose in the West, especially in the US, because of trade, leads intellectuals in developing countries also to say, well, inequality is a problem for us, globalization is a problem for us. And I think we have to be a bit careful here to see what the impacts on our own economies are as a result of this. Because as I said earlier, the first order effect on China and India was that massive gains, of course, not all completely equally shared, but because the rhetoric of, oh my God, inequality, we tend to articulate and discuss these things in the same terms that the discussion happens in advanced countries. And I just want to caution against that. On Amit's point, Amit and co-authors have done some excellent work on the first round and what happened to Vietnam, Mexico, but not India. But my sense is, and here this is speculation, that Trump too is going to be a bit different, going to be much more aggressive in terms of higher tariffs, but also he doesn't like friendshoring. If stuff is coming from Vietnam to the US instead of from China, my sense is that he may get very aggressive on that via very restrictive rules of origin. So I think therefore that developing countries, including the ones who benefit the first time around, have to be extra vigilant and think about what happens if these things get much tighter. And this is an extreme case where Trump basically says, I'm going to smash the China value chain. So stuff coming from Mexico to the US with Chinese inputs, they may get tighter on that. They may say, well, if the Chinese firms involved, that too will not happen. Chinese technology involved, that too will not happen. It's potentially more serious. The impacts on trade could be much more adverse. So in that sense, countries like India have a little bit of an advantage that they have the potential to develop these things outside of the China value chain. And that's the new kind of opportunity going ahead. But I'm speculating. I don't know, but I sense that this is going to be more tough on trade than the first round. I don't know what you think, Amit.
The 2018-19 tariffs was an opportunity that presented itself because it was largely a trade war that the US was imposing on China. And now we see rhetoric of not just ratcheting up of tariffs on China, but also increasing the tariffs on all other trade partners. To some extent, if you're a policymaker in a developing country, this is an opportunity. And so you do want to be thinking about the domestic conditions that give rise to your ability to take advantage. And so if you don't see yourself taking advantage in the first case, this should be raising questions as to what it could be the labor laws, it could be land laws, it could be factoring markets, which allow companies to get access to credit. It could be that companies in developing countries don't actually understand the rules of origins that are necessary. And so there's a litany of challenges that are not really so much trade related, that are domestic policy related, that if anything, the opportunities that have been availed themselves through increased tensions between US and China for other developing countries, it should peel back that curtain and say, okay, what do we need to be thinking about in order to be responsive?
If India has to take advantage of the China plus one opportunity, you have to appease Trump. So one way to do it is just to, you know, enter into an agreement with the United States saying, we'll open up our markets as a quid pro quo for being able to exploit the China plus one opportunity. And I think, as Isabella says, different countries will have to do different kinds of trade agreements with different partners. But for India in particular, the China plus one opportunity risks once again being squandered. I think domestic actions that Amit says, absolutely first order. But in addition, you may have to have strategic engagement with the US or with other trading partners in order to take advantage of some of the opportunities that have been created.
Although we're seeing globalization under attack through actions of the US and other kind of advanced countries, it is the case that there is a lot of trade happening around the world and it's increasing in fast-growing markets. India in particular, I think Praveen Krishna has shown that it's either has signed or is in the process of signing 15 trade agreements. Trade between the Gulf and parts of Africa is increasing rapidly. So I think these are also things to keep in mind, that trade is advancing, I think, in development and in around the world, and that gives rise for opportunities. But also some of the points that Isabella raised, which is it does give some concerns about how the benefits of those opportunities are distributed.
I think we shouldn't forget also that after the global financial crisis, although trade in goods suffered, trade in services has continued to grow apace. So that opportunity is there for all those countries that have the ability to export and trade in services.
At this moment, there are many unknowns and there will likely be a lot of change. It could also be an opportunity for rethinking international trade. And I know this was something outlined in the Vox Dev Lit, asking whether the current global trade framework is sufficient to address the challenges that developing countries face. So to the extent that this could be a moment for a productive shift, anything else you haven't outlined that you would call for or hope to see or that the research suggests could happen?
Let me speak research-free, unlike Isabella and Amit. Unburdened by research, let me hold forth. See, I think that there's this big discussion about should we redo the global trading order. I think, frankly, we're being ostriches in the sand here. The way I like to put it is that with the US, China, and EU basically at loggerheads with each other, the prospects for any meaningful cooperation, at least on a multilateral level, are pretty dim. And so it's going to be each country opportunistically trying to figure out what we can do. The notion that we can have any new multilateral framework is completely pie in the sky at this stage, because the US and China, the biggest traders, are at existential war with each other. And under Trump, that's going to happen. And so the way I like to put it is that, can we get international public goods without international public cooperation? And I think that's the challenge going forward, especially in the area of climate change and maybe trade as well.
I agree with Arvind that it's hard to see a path forward to improve our global mechanisms for alleviating some of the tensions that have been rising over the past 8 years or so. But there are some big challenges to be solved, climate being one of them. And we're going to be seeing what are known as carbon border adjustment mechanism tariffs being put in place by the EU by the end of next year. And there were many countries that were frustrated with the process of the WTO, including the United States, which is one of the justifications for why they went unilateral. And so whether it's possible to reform the existing institutions so that parties who believe that other countries are pursuing unfair trade practices can use the WTO as a mechanism to deal with that problem, as opposed to doing things unilaterally, that would be my preferred hope that we can find that path. Although I think it may be the case that it's just at the moment, I just don't see that in sight.
Maybe I'm the optimist in the room. I still think that for most developing countries, they are not strong enough to enter bilateral negotiations with world powers such as the United States and not get much smaller share of the pie. So for those countries, I think they are weakened by not relying on the alliances that they're already part of. So I'm thinking here of Brexit, for instance, and the kind of trade agreements that the UK had hoped for itself once it left the European Union. And I think there's overwhelming consensus now that the UK economy is weaker now that it is no longer bargaining as a bloc together with the European Union. So while I agree that many alliances have been weakened by the quasi-exit of their main actors for the smaller economies, they're not going to be on the winning end when they enter in this transactional one-to-one bargainings with countries such as the United States. Everyone hopes that they can outsmart the other in the negotiation, but I still think that they are stronger together.
Well, let me just end on a note of optimism on climate change. Amit quite rightly said all these trade measures are coming in, carbon border adjustments, so on, which I think developing countries rightly regard as protectionist against them. When I say we need international public goods without international public cooperation, one answer to that is just technological revolution. For example, if technology like renewables prices comes down, because, you know, remember, China's greatest gift for climate change was subsidized subsidize solar panels, if the US can do this for batteries or whatever, and if costs of renewables comes down, especially with storage, each country will find it in its national interest, and the private sector will see it financially viable to actually invest in renewables. And then in that case, the need for cooperation doesn't go away, but it gets lessened to some extent. So in that sense, I think the best thing that could happen to the world is an absolute subsidy war when it comes to, you know, technology. Bring it on, I say, and bring down the price of renewables.
Well, that's a powerful call to action to end on. Amit, Isabella, Arvind, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
That's all for this episode of Development Dialogues. If you'd like to learn more about the Economic Growth Center, you can visit egc.yale.edu, where you can sign up for the EGC newsletter. And if you'd like to learn more about VoxDev, head to voxdev.org, where you can also explore the VoxDev Lit on international trade. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and consider sharing it and leaving a rating and review. And look for the next installment of Development Dialogues wherever you get your podcasts.